I have chosen some sutras from another one of the Samyutta Nikaya. Samyutta means collected, so there's many, many different chapters, and each one of those chapters, they collect discourses on one topic. And 2 weeks ago, I used some of the sutras in the collection on dependent origination. And today, there's some sutras here on the collection of Satipatthana, which many of you would know is an important part of the Dhamma, but when I read these out, you see some different angles on the Satipatthana, which you may have never noticed before, because these are very rarely talked about. Usually when you talk about Satipatthana, you just do the Satipatthana Sutra, never mentioning the Satipatthana Samyutta, where you've got some interesting extras, which you are soon to find out. So I've got 4 sutras here. I'm not sure if we get through all of them. The 4th one, maybe we can put it in there, maybe not, but it's there anyway for you. But the first one, Bhikkhuni's Quarter, is the name of it. First of all, it just introduces the Satipatthana and also gives a nice, interesting way of it being practiced. And I mention this because there has been a debate in Buddhism for years, for centuries actually, on is Satipatthana vipassana? Is it samatha? Is Satipatthana an alternative to doing jhanas, just to get enlightened? And now you will soon find out how the Buddha taught Satipatthana. Exciting. Listen, and you will be amazed. Though the Bhikkhuni's Quarter. Then in the morning, the Venerable Ananda, dressed and taking bowl and robe, he approached the Bhikkhuni's Quarters and sat down in the appointed seat. Then a number of Bhikkhuni's approached the Venerable Ananda, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, "Here, Venerable Ananda, a number of Bhikkhuni's, dwelling with their minds well established in the 4 establishments of mindfulness, perceive successively loftier stages of distinction." In other words, stages of distinction on the path. Things like jhanas, things like sowan or stream winning. I've been in Sri Lanka too long. Stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or arahat. And so Ananda replies, "So it is, sisters, so it is. It may be expected of anyone, sisters, whether bhikkhu or bhikkhuni, who dwells with a mind well established in the 4 establishments of mindfulness, that such a one will perceive successively loftier stages of distinction." And so it doesn't actually say usually what the distinction is, but it's usually understood as another word for what in Buddhism called the uttari manusa dhamma, the higher states of human beings. And those are things like the jhanas, like the stages of enlightenment. Then the Venerable Ananda instructed, exhorted, inspired, and gladdened those bhikkhunis with a Dhamma talk, after which he rose from his seat and left. And that's just an interesting part there. In the time of the Buddha, there were bhikkhunis, and many of them were getting enlightened, as it says here, perceiving successfully loftier stages of distinction. And the monks would sometimes go there to teach the bhikkhunis. Do you think the bhikkhunis would ever teach the monks? Ha 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 ha. It's nice when I throw those questions out. There is the Mahavedala or Churavedala Sutta. One of the sutras is a bhikkhuni teaching a monk in the sutras. There we go. So the bhikkhunis would even give sutras and teachings to the monks, which was so good, it's in the Pali Canon. So anyway, this is Ananda. Ananda left, and Venerable Ananda walked for alms in Sarvati, and when he had returned from the alms round after his meal, he approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and reported all that had happened. And the Blessed One said, "So it is, Ananda, so it is. It may be expected of anyone, Ananda, whether bhikkhu or bhikkhuni." And you could say here, upasaka, upasika, which means you, lay men, lay women, who dwell with the mind well established in the 4 establishments of mindfulness, that such a one will perceive successively loftier stages of distinction. What for? Now you see here there's a little bit of extra than you see in the Satipatthana Sutra, which is why this is a nice juicy little sutra. What for? The four foundations of mindfulness. Ananda, a bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body in the body. You have to stop there, as you've heard me teach before. The body in the body doesn't mean the body in the body. It just means contemplating the body. This is a uniqueness of the Pali language. Whenever you say two words, it usually means one word or even less. They do past sweeping of paths. They do teeth brushing of teeth. They do car driving of cars. Whenever you have the verb, you actually repeat the object of the verb. So you house clean a house. So that's the verb is house cleaning. And the object is obviously a house. So you don't, say for example in Pali, you don't walk the dog. You dog walk the dog. Now that's just an idiosyncrasy of that ancient language. You know, then so you glass clean your glasses. And so you body contemplate, that's the verb, the body. And that's what it really means. So it's never think of it as contemplating the body in the body, just means contemplating the body. Nice and simple. A monk dwells, or bhikkhuni, layman, laywoman, dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehending mindfulness, and of course this other thing which I keep on about, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. And what does that mean? That is lokeya bija domanasang, which is used elsewhere in the Pali. When I learned Pali and I started to read these books in the Pali original, a few things really stood out. And what stood out here is this word which you saw in the Satipatthana again and again. Lokeya bija is a synonym for the first hindrance of the five hindrances. Many, 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 many times. Instead of having the usual kamachanda, this sort of sensory desire they usually call it, as the first hindrance, sometimes they have lokeya bija, what you have here. So that's first hindrance. And what they have here, covetousness for the world. That's the first hindrance, the first nivarana. And the second one, domanasa, there is two places where that's a synonym for the second hindrance. Oh. And all the commentaries, they all say that's exactly what that means. So it's actually having got rid of the first two of the hindrances. So that makes it much easier to understand that, you know, you have to have done some meditation to get rid of those hindrances. It's not just thinking. So, I'm now going to change that. What for? Here Ananda, a monk dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances. While they are contemplating the body, there arises in them, based on the body, basically based on this contemplation, either fever in the body, fever is not really the right word, anything which makes you hot, you know, thinking of an opposite sex, thinking of food, anything to do with the body like that. Fever to the body, or was it rising in a fever in the body, or the sluggishness of the mind, or the mind is distracted outwardly. Then the monk should then direct his mind to some inspiring sign. You know what the word of a sign is? Nimitta. When you direct your mind to something inspiring, gladness is born. When you are gladdened, rapture is born. When the mind is uplifted by rapture, the body becomes tranquil. When the body is tranquil, you experience happiness. When the mind of one who is happy becomes still, not concentrated, that's samadhi. And this is a common causal sequence you find again and again and again in the sutras. And here it's in the Satipatthana Sutra. You know, when you get something inspiring, then you get this gladness. And gladness is the cause of this piti, this joy coming up. And when this joy comes up, that makes the body and the mind tranquil. When it's tranquil, you get this sukha coming up, this special type of meditation happiness. And when you have that happiness, you enter samadhi. And samadhi is always the jhanas, the samasamadhi. This is a common sequence. And it should always be remembered, you don't just make the mind still by willpower. You wisdom power, you know the causes. Get something inspiring up. And when inspiring, you get this piti. You know what it means when you're really inspired, you get lots of energetic joy. And when you have that lots of energy, it's so easy to make the body calm and the mind calm as well. And then you get this beautiful bliss of calmness. That's the sukha. And that is the focus, the object, which takes you all the way into jhanas. And it's such a simple thing when you remember it, but it's needed to be done again and again and again. So look, if you're meditating, you're getting nowhere. Think of something inspiring. Something which uplifts you. Something which is, wow, that was such an amazing thing. And there's lots and lots and lots of objects of inspiration which you can use. It can be just, you know, some amazing act of kindness you've just seen. A great act of generosity. Just all the amazing people who work for this place to make it happen. It could be, you know, some past sutra which you read which you think, wow, that really makes sense, which really inspires you. When you start from that, it's very easy, it just happens. You get this piti, this great joy coming up, because you're inspired, you have energy. And then it's so easy to make your body so peaceful, so still, it vanishes. Through happiness, never through pain. That's one of the Buddha's great mistakes before he became enlightened. Trying to get his body tranquil through pain, it never works that way. Instead, through comfort, that's why we have these beautiful chairs and cushions where people, the wise ones, there's only one wise one here today, can lean against the wall. That's what we have the walls for. Not just to hold on the roof, to lean on. So this is important to actually to understand this whole process. I'll say it once more, you know, just from inspiration. And there's other suttas where they say, like, just the Dhamma. Remember some incredible, powerful Dhamma which really inspires you. You know, I've got a few of these little phrases. I was talking about this at the Sutta class yesterday. You know, from the Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveller on it is found. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters. That is so beautiful. So I can repeat that, and wow, that's really good. And it just makes my travel vanish. So those were inspiration. Once you get inspiration, from inspiration, piti, the joy, tranquility, it's called prasaddhi, sukha, which is this, another type of happiness, you know, just the happiness of peace, and then samadhi, the great stillness. Those are the four which happen. And I have it, satipatthana practice. So, then one, the mind of one who's happy becomes still. Then you reflect, the purpose for the sake of which I directed my mind has been achieved. So you've done that, the inspiration, so you don't have to do it anymore. So you don't, so you now withdraw it. And withdrawing the mind does not think or examine. You understand without thought and examination, internally mindful, I am happy. What is that? That is always without vitakka vichara. That's what it says here. So even the commentaries, and basically there's no other explanation, this, they've entered the jhana. That is the description of second jhana, without the vitakka vichara. And it doesn't mean thought and examination, it means without the mind moving. You're internally mindful and still. That's one of the other things which I keep on saying, because when I was over in Sri Lanka last week, the monks were always saying, well, you know, are you really aware when you're in jhanas? Of course you're aware, it's fully aware, totally aware. You're internally mindful, because this is on the satipatthana, on directing mindfulness, establishing mindfulness. The jhanas are great mindfulness states. So what I understand from this one is that person's doing the satipatthana practice, first of all on the body, then they repeat it for the other three, which I'll go in very soon afterwards. You're doing the satipatthana sutra, satipatthana practice, and then, you know, something arises in, if you're doing the body, connected with the body, you have like some sort of lust or fever or want or some tiredness or sluggishness of the body, which you all know in meditation, just feel nothing's really happening, or there's some distraction outwardly, what do? And then they say basically get some inspiration coming up get into jhana, and then you are very, very peaceful and still. Do you understand that? Okay, let's do number two, number three, and number four, and see if anyone has any questions on that. Again, a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, dwells contemplating feelings. This is Vedana, pleasure, pain, on any part of the six senses. The jitta, the mind, and phenomena is Dhamma, ardent, clearly comprehended, mindful, having removed the two hindrances. While you're contemplating Dhamma, there arises in them, based on the Dhamma, either some fever in the body or sluggishness of mind, or the mind is distracted outwardly, then the meditator should direct the mind towards some inspiring sign. When you direct it to some inspiring sign, gladness is born. When you're gladdened, rapture arises. When there is rapture, the body becomes tranquil. When the tranquil in body, you experience happiness. When the mind of one who is happy becomes still, and you reflect the purpose for the sake of which I directed my mind has been achieved. Let me now withdraw it, and you enter the second jhana. In such a way, Ananda, there is development by direction. So he's saying that these nuns are getting all of this stuff. And how, Ananda, is there development without direction? Not directing the mind outwardly. The monk understands, my mind is not directed outwardly. You understand? In other words, it's directed inwardly. It's not directed onto these signs and going into the jhanas. It is unconstricted after and before, liberated, undirected. Then they further understand, I dwell contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehended, mindful, I am happy. Not directing the mind outwardly, the monk understands, my mind is not directed outwardly, you understand, it is unconstricted after, liberated, undirected. I should dwell contemplating the feelings, ardent, clearly comprehended, mindful, I am happy. Or not directing the third satipatthana, not directing his mind outwardly, the monk understands, my mind is not directed outwardly, you understand, it is unconstricted after and before, liberated and undirected, you further understand, I dwell contemplating mind and mind. I am clearly comprehended, mindful, I am happy, not directing your mind outwardly, a monk understands, my mind is not directed outwardly, you understand, it is unconstricted after and before, liberated, undirected, then he further understands, I dwell contemplating the Dhamma, ardent, clearly comprehended, mindful, I am happy. It is this way, Ananda, there is development without direction. So basically this is a case where because everything is going well, you don't have this. When you are meditating on the four satipatthanas, you do not have the either based on this object, which one you're doing, or the mind is being sluggish, or the mind is distracted. So if you have no problem, you don't need to direct the mind. So this is where the satipatthana and the jhanas, they work together. Basically, if you're doing satipatthana and you start to get some desires, some, let's say here, fever with the body, sluggishness, some distraction, then you have to go and get some stillness going on by getting the samadhi, get an inspiring sign, get pamuja, the joy, the piti, the gladness, the joy, the tranquility of the body, the happiness, and then the stillness of samadhi. And then you can actually go further, but if you don't have the problems, the stillness is not required, you can carry on doing the satipatthana, not having directed your mind onto this path to samadhi. It is not needed, the stillness is not necessary. Does that make sense? Or have I confused you? Okay, I will sum it up again. You see that the Buddha is talking about two ways of doing the four satipatthana here. One with direction, one without direction, he's saying. And the first one, the direction is used if when doing the satipatthana contemplation of the body, feelings, mind, or dhammas, I sometimes call that mind objects. When you're doing that satipatthana practice, if You know, there is some fever of the body. I'm not talking about physical fevers like getting a cold or a Ebola virus or something. We're talking about just some hotness in the body because you want something, you're bothered about something. Or if there's sluggishness, tiredness of the body, just basically, you know, your mind doesn't want to work. And the other one is you get distracted. Basically, sloth and torpor, restlessness. You know, some obsession, sloth and torpor, restlessness arises while you're doing satipatthana. Then you do this practice of stilling the mind. And that stilling the mind is the practice of getting some inspiring object. You're doing that on purpose. Doing something, inspiring it. And then that gets into the stillness. And as if you were here yesterday afternoon, you'd have heard me say the stillness is what empowers the mindfulness and overcomes the sluggishness, the restlessness, and any fevers. And then, you know, that you don't need sort of that directed practice anymore. So then you can do the second part, which is the undirected practice. In other words, you have enough mindfulness, enough stillness to do the satipatthana. So in brief, if you do satipatthana practice, basically you're contemplating the body, contemplating feelings, contemplating the mind, contemplating mind objects. If there's any problem, then you make the mind still. Give a boost to your energy of mindfulness through stillness. And then when the energy is strong enough, so you don't have the sluggishness nor the distraction, then you go back to undirected. You just do the satipatthana and let it happen. Sometimes, because people can be a bit stupid, they get sluggish, and you just get into the dullness, and people can be dull for hours. You can see them sometimes on meditation retreats, the head almost touching the floor. And sometimes they can be restless for hours. It's amazing just how long you can think about stuff, absolutely stupid stuff, for hours. So sometimes you do need to interrupt it sometimes. And this is giving a nice little bit of instructions on how to interrupt it and just get some inspiration up. And from inspiration, mind gets very still, you get some power. And then if you want to do the contemplation of satipatthana, then you don't need to direct it anymore, it just happens. Yes. Of course, it's a very desirable object. But I like the idea when it says this apalidara, it means something you just don't do, you don't direct it. So, if you don't need it because you've got enough energy, these things happen automatically. No direction. Don't need it because you've got enough mindfulness and energy, you don't need to interrupt the process. Yes. Of course it can, as long as I have to interrupt you there, as long as you have the seven other factors as well. No, the seven other factors plus satipatthana make eight. Eightfold path. Yeah? That is part of the bojangas, indeed. And as you're talking about the seven bojangas, which are the enlightenment factors, and there you do have piti, pasadi, and they don't have sukha in there, but they have samadhi and upeka. But the nice thing that these are enlightenment factors, piti, joy. So if someone is miserable, they haven't got one of the important enlightenment factors. They cannot be enlightened if they're miserable. Piti is joy, that's part of the enlightenment factors. The way into enlightenment and what it's like to be enlightened. You're supposed to be a happy person. Yeah. Refined states of stillness, of samadhi. That's why, you know, these jhanas, incredible states of happiness. Yes. Yeah. No, no, you see here, this is the Satipatthana way, and it includes the jhana way. So when you're doing Satipatthana, this is how to do the Satipatthana. This is Satipatthana Samyutta, all about Satipatthana. If you're doing Satipatthana, you can't do it without the jhanas. So the jhanas, you know, you're doing Satipatthana basically, and you just get a bit tired, or something happens, you've got to do a jhana, increase your mindfulness, your energy, and then you can go back to your Satipatthana again, but you can't do without that. It's one of the other things that you can't, there's no such thing that Satipatthana is the only way to enlightenment. There's only one way to enlightenment, Eddie, and that's the Eightfold Path. Yes? You are doing now, we are doing the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah. So the whole lot is Satipatthana. It's also the whole lot is Samatha. The whole lot is Eightfold Path. So this is an important thing. Maybe here because you've been well brainwashed by me and my other monks here. But if you go any other places, they say, what are you doing? You do Samatha or do you do Vipassana? Which is the way? And I keep telling people, we don't teach Samatha in this monastery. I said, but I thought you teach jhanas. I said, well, that's part of it. I teach Eightfold Path. Not jhanas, not Samatha. We don't teach Vipassana, we teach Eightfold Path. I spend hours and hours teaching people to keep their precepts, giving the five precepts, the eight precepts, and goodness knows how many other precepts. That's part of the practice. That's part of the Eightfold Path. Number 3, 4, and 5. Sama Vacha, Sama Kammanto, Sama Ajivo. That's also important. So the argument between Samatha and Vipassana all came, just forgetting everything else about the Eightfold Path and just focusing on two factors, which one are you doing? Seeing both and all the other six as well. And one of the problems comes, and you're very happy, lucky in being in a place like this. In some places, they say only be mindful. None of the other factors, certainly not right speech. You can call a person an idiot or whatever you like. You know, not right action. You know, you can have sex with whoever you want. You know, and there are places like this, honestly. You can have sex as long as you don't get attached. It's weird. I remember I was there in Thailand when this American teacher came along to see Ajahn Chah. And, you know, sort of this teacher, you know, this American Buddhism, please excuse me, in those days. They're not all like this, but this one was. And he said, oh, you know, you ask Ajahn Chah, it's all right, you know, to have sex with your disciples, you know, as long as you're not attached and you can let it go afterwards. And Ajahn Chah said, that's like having salt which is not salty. He said, you know, you will get attached. But anyway, sort of, you know, that's the thing, you've got to have the whole Eightfold Path. What is it? Eight. Not Samatha. That's one. Not Vipassana, that's one. Not Samatha and Vipassana, that's this two. Eightfold Path. And here I'm just seeing here that with the Satipatthana, you have to get the jhana in there somewhere. Okay, well, I'll just finish off this because the next one reinforces it. But here we go. Thus, Ananda, I have taught, developed by direction, I have taught, developed without direction. Whatever should be done, Ananda, by a compassionate teacher, out of compassion for his disciples, desiring the welfare I have done for you. And then after teaching, this is one of the things we all love about the Buddha, he said, don't just listen to it and go home saying, that's interesting. He carries on, these are the feet of trees, Ananda, these are the empty places. Meditate, Ananda, do not be negligent lest you regret it later. This is our instruction to you. And it's also my instruction to you. We don't just teach like this, come on. There are empty places, there's quiet rooms in your house somewhere. You know, it's a bit sort of wet to go sit at the foot of a tree, but, you know, don't just listen, just practice. This is what the Blessed One said, elated, Ananda delighted in the Blessed One's statement. Now, what matches this one is one of my favorite sutras. in the Satipatthana Samyutta, which is called the cook. And there are two reasons I like this. Number one, because you cook for me. And this is because, you know, we alms food. So I have an underlying motive for teaching you this one, as you will soon find out. And number two, it is reinforcing the fact that you have to sometimes, if you want to do Satipatthana contemplation, you have to get your mind, you know, strong by doing some samatha. Bhikkhus, first of all, the incompetent cook. Suppose a foolish, incompetent, unskillful cook, you know they always have two or three words when you can just say one, were to present a king or a royal minister, and I had in here, or a monk, with various kinds of curries, sour, bitter, pungent, sweet, sharp, mild, salty, bland, that foolish, incompetent, unskillful cook does not pick up the sign of his own master's preference. Today this curry pleased my master, or he reached for this one, or he took a lot of that one, or he spoke in praise of this one, or the sour curry pleased my master today, or he reached for the sour one, or he took a lot of the sour one, or he spoke in praise of the sour one, or the bitter curry, the pungent, the sweet, the sharp, the mild, the salty, the bland curry pleased my master, or he spoke in praise of the bland one. That foolish, incompetent, unskillful cook, because he doesn't notice those things, does not gain gifts of clothing, wages, and bonuses. For what reason? Because that foolish, incompetent, unskillful cook does not pick up the sign of his own master's preferences. You can see where I'm going on this one. So too, monks. Here's some foolish, incompetent, unskillful monk. Nun, nay man, nay women. Dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances. While they dwell contemplating the body, the mind has not become still. The corruptions are not abandoned. He does not pick up the sign that these things aren't happening. You dwell contemplating feelings, contemplating mind, contemplating dhammas, mind objects. Ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances. While you dwell contemplating dhammas, your mind does not become still. The corruptions are not abandoned. You do not pick up the sign of that. That foolish, incompetent, unskillful monk does not gain pleasant dwellings in this very life, nor does he gain mindfulness and clear comprehension. For what reason? Because amongst that foolish, incompetent, unskillful monk does not pick up the sign of his own mind. See whether it's still, whether it's got corruptions, what's happening in there. Now we have the competent cook. Suppose monks, a wise, competent, skillful cook, were to present a king or a royal minister or a monk or a nun with various kinds of curries, sour, bitter, pungent, sweet, sharp, mild, salty, bland. That wise, competent, skillful cook picks up the sign of his own master's preference. Today this curry pleased my master, or he spoke in praise of that one. That wise, competent, skillful cook gains gifts of clothing, wages, and bonuses. For what reason? Because that wise, competent, skillful cook picks up the sign of his own master's preferences. So, monks, here's some wise, competent, skillful monk, nun, layman, laywoman, dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances, while he dwells contemplating the body, the mind becomes still, the corruptions are abandoned, he picks up that sign. He finds out what works. He dwells contemplating feelings, mind, phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances. While he dwells contemplating the dhammas, his mind becomes still, the corruptions are abandoned, he picks up the sign. That wise, skillful monk gains pleasant dwellings in this very life, gains mindfulness and clear comprehension. Why? Because that monk, that wise, competent, skillful bhikkhu, picks up the sign of his own mind. So this is actually, it's not just doing these things. It's sometimes learning what works, what doesn't work.
that makes sense to you. And I know that because sometimes people keep bringing the same food to the monasteries and it never gets eaten. And they bring it the next day as well, and the next week, and the next week. Come on.
So that's my underlying motive there, so I can look after my monks and we don't get too much wasted. Because I must say this, there's any Thai people here? Okay, I can say this, because some of the Thai people, they have this idea. I would never have this in Sri Lanka or anywhere else. They have this idea, whatever you offer to a monk, then that's the food you will get after you die and go to heaven. So, you know, if you like durian, you have to give a durian to a monk and he has to eat it. Whether the monk likes it or not is not the point. It's, you know, whether you're going to eat that in heaven or not. Because I remember that from bitter memory, because when Ajahn Chakwa was the abbot, he was away somewhere, and so someone offered durian, and I never took it. It's, you know, it smells, but I don't mind it, you know, but you don't have it these days. You used to have it. And so I didn't take it. And she complained when Ajahn Chakwa got back. That's really unfair. Ajahn Brahm never ate my durian. That means I can't get durian when I go to heaven. He's going to torture me because I never took it. And also, even recently, please again, don't be so stupid. About a year ago, I think this monk might remember, somebody gave, you know, the Sangha Dana, you know, it's a whole bucket of stuff. You know, it was actually at Serpentine. A whole bucket of stuff, you know, soap powder, toothpaste and stuff, a whole bucket. So, you know, I receive it and take it to the Anagara, because they take it downstairs to unpack, and they came up 5 minutes later, right in the bottom was a bottle of whiskey. It's absolutely true. Now, hidden in the bottom, because they knew if I'd have seen it, I wouldn't have accepted it. And why did they do that for? So that was dedicated to their father. So their father could drink whiskey up in heaven. They had to give it to a monk first. And that's crazy. It doesn't work that way. Exactly. I wonder what monk is telling them. Look, if your father really wants to have whiskey up in heaven, the only way to do that is to give some to... There are some crazy monks around, unfortunately. So, sorry? Yeah, if you're brought up with that culture. But that is not how it works, obviously. It's not just the stuff you give, it's the heart from which you give. That's more important. You know, it's just like giving people credits. You know, if you get credits, you can get whatever you want. You don't have to get sort of, you know, what you sort of gave the monk, you just credits. So you can do whatever you want. But Oh, yeah, I tell them, yeah, but don't do that. It's crazy, giving monks, you know, a bottle of whiskey. I was very happy they found it quickly. And no reporter was there and said, oh, you know, we just come to the monastery today, we found out the monks take whiskey, they don't tell anyone, they keep it secret. Oh, no, we threw it away. Down the sink it goes. Yeah. Yeah. At least that's what they told me they did. Of course they do that. It's only a tiny bottle, but still. Anyway, so this is, you know, the cook understands what, you know, the Sangha eat. And also, I mentioned this actually when I was in Sri Lanka. Be careful over there if you tell your friends, because talking to the monks, they said over 50% of the monks in Sri Lanka have got bad stomachs. They've got stomach problems. And it's, a lot of times it's because you're not looking at what the monks actually eat there. And they're eating just, I think they said, far too oily, far too salty. You know, because people want to make the best food. You know, what they think the monks really want to eat, which is always the most fancy food. And, you know, a lot of times you ask the monks here, and I don't mind saying, you like simple food. You don't have to make it fancy. You know, but people say, oh no, these are monks, these are like royalty, these are like gods. You know, we can't just have ordinary food. You know, it has to have the very, very best. And then sometimes you're making your monk sick.
I remember years ago being told, monks live simply, they eat simply. And when I was in Sri Lanka, I was told,
Yeah, exactly. Why do people do that? Yeah, I get confused too. And keep it simple, for goodness sake. You know, just can of baked beans, that does me. I shouldn't say that, because otherwise I always get this wrong, because every time I say something, monks have told me, don't say anything about food, because the next day that's all I get. For weeks. But you know, just keep it simple. Especially if you can tell your friends in Sri Lanka that, because there's too many monks are getting sick because of food. Keep it simple. Yeah. Ah, yeah. Okay, now there's two things about that. First of all, the sign of the mind. You can see it that the cook picks up the sign of the food and his master. So, in other words, you're mindful to see what works, see what causes joy, you know, to the king or whoever you're cooking the food for. See what's taken. He enjoys that. So see what sort of way of doing satipatthana, again, causes joy and happiness. So what makes the mind free and peaceful? You know, what makes it still? Because it says in here, it's the competent cook. Because then while dwelling, contemplating the body, the mind becomes still. The corruptions are abandoned. You pick up that sign. That this is what's actually happening, it's working. This is what the satipatthana is supposed to be doing. Causing stillness. And they keep on saying, when you see things, when you do get insight, that creates stillness. Your insight, you see what the problem is. You see it's only the body, which means you don't worry about it anymore. Which means you get very still and peaceful. Yes, exactly. You see that. Instead of just doing the old thing, just like offering food because this is what your parents used to do and this that way. Don't just do it that way. See what works, what is helpful. You know, you can see that in traditional Buddhism. Always do the things the same old way. And just without picking up the sign. This is really helping Buddhism. You know, just offering bottles of whiskey to a monk because you think that's going to make your grandfather have whiskey when he gets to heaven. Is that really working? You pick up the signs. Because you know what it's like in any religion, especially Buddhism now, sometimes these cultural accretions keep on coming on and on and on and on. And just, you know, because this is the way Ajahn Brahm used to do it, so it becomes the way it has to be done. You know, there's going to be cultural accretions here, just in my time being here, and there's always going to be these accretions, but, you know, take them away as soon as you possibly can. So you see the sign, what works, what doesn't work. And it's also, the other thing I wanted to point out here, that this is where the satipatthana lead to. If you do the contemplating the body properly, feelings, mind objects, the proper way when you pick up the sign, then it leads to, the competent cook here. While dwell contemplating the body, the mind becomes still. Samadhi. Now, if you do the satipatthana properly, it leads into jhanas. It's not an alternative. The satipatthana actually creates the jhanas. And because of the jhanas, the corruptions, the defilements of the mind, they all get abandoned because you picked up the sign. So satipatthana, you don't look at it in isolation. And it's based, you know, on your precepts, on a bit of right view. And it leads to the stillness of samadhi. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes. What to do always is get something inspiring, as it said in the previous one. Now that's a very, very good piece of advice. Because sometimes your meditation's dull. Instead of just sitting there getting duller and duller and duller, inspire the mind. So when I was in Sri Lanka, I told the monks, I was the whole day with them, teaching them some meditation tricks. I said, okay, everyone sit down now. Close your eyes, get your body comfortable. Now imagine, just imagine you're an arahat. Imagine and sit down, imagine you're an arahat. Imagine what it must be like, being an arahat, fully enlightened. Now these were monks who'd been immersed, you know, in that tradition since they were born. So, you know, they would have some feeling of what an arahat really is. You know, no desire, no sort of ill will, just perfectly at peace with the whole world, and beautiful energy. Imagine that. So they're all sitting down there, imagining they were arahats. Now that's inspiring. That gets you going. And even you may not sort of have the same real deep understanding, you know, because of your culture, what an arahat is. You know, because you go in Sri Lanka and they say every square meter of that land, an arahat has walked on it. And you know, you go to these ancient temples, and yeah, there's been a few of them around in those temples. And so they've got this feeling in their culture. So you may not have that strength of the idea of the enlightened being, but still you have enough idea of it. That you can sit down there and just, okay, imagine I'm an arahat. Sit down here. That inspires you. That gets you started. That gives you a boost. You know, you're a bit further along the path. Those are the sorts of little tricks to inspire yourself. You know, that it can be done, you're doing it. And that really just gives you the boost of energy. You get the gladness. And this whole process happens, you get very still very quickly. Okay, now, very quick, sutta, the origination. Now, I mention this one because a lot of times that people think that you're doing the Satipatthana Sutta, and it's only a very short one, and it gets there that contemplating the body, the feelings, the mind and the mind objects or dhammas, and then sometimes, you know, you watch the rise, watch the fall, and so often that people say that that's doing Satipatthana, they're just watching the rise and fall of things, without realizing what the rise and fall is really meant to be. And that's in this origination, the 42nd sutta in the Satipatthana Samyutta. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the origination and the passing away of the four establishments of mindfulness. Listen to that. What is the origination of the body? Because they say, what's the rise of the body, the fall of the body, in oneself, in others, or in both, in the Satipatthana. What does it mean? The origin and passing away, the rise and fall of the body, say. Now this is what it says. With the origination of nutriment, there is origination of the body. With the cessation of nutriment, there is a passing away of the body. And the nutriments for the body, if I can remember this, what are they? There's obviously the food, and there's also sensory contact, there is also will, and that is also like mind as well, consciousness. Those, I think, the four nutriments, if I'm correct, for the origination and maintenance of this body. What's really interesting there, yeah, food, you can understand, if you starve, you're going to die. But also sensory contact. If you don't have sensory contact, you pass away. Now this, I always mention this, is so important if ever you have someone in a coma. Because sometimes when they don't get sensory contact, and you don't bother speaking to them because you think they can't hear, you don't bother holding their hand, you know, it means that they're one of the important sources for them to survive. It's not just food, it's the sensory contact is taken away, they pass away. So if you've got someone in a coma and you really want to see if you can keep them alive, talk to them, hold them, stroke their hair, anything to give them some sensory input. Because without that sensory input, it's like starving them. And I think I read in the Saturday paper, there was somebody in a coma, and they were into music, and they were doing some play, some Disney play or something, and they started singing, like, give us a whistle or something. And that got them out of a coma. You know, I don't know, I haven't watched Disney for a long time, but apparently there's an old Disney character was always whistling and said, give us a whistle, and the guy suddenly whistled, he'd been in a coma for days. You know, they'd stimulated something from sound.
So if you don't have that sensory stimulation, you know, you die. Yeah.
But the doctors were telling the first wife,
yeah,
keep calling in the ear his name, keep on and on.
Yeah.
And even for me, I knew that that was wrong.
Okay, well, if you want to let go, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it depends on that. If it's, you know, if it's your husband, he never sort of comes when you call him when he's alive, so he's not going to come when he's dead. No, but yeah, I see your point there, but you can see that, you know, that would actually drag him out of a coma. So if you really want to let them go, it's the time for them to go, then, you know, don't call them. Don't touch them. Because that will stimulate them, get them back again. So that's one of the nutriments for the body. And the other one is will. And it's the old will to live. People who give up the will to live, it's like starving themselves. They die. And the other one is need consciousness there, somewhere in there, to keep the body alive. So these are very powerful perceptions of the Buddha, the nutriments which cause the body to come up, maintain it. And when those four disappear, you die. That is the arising and passing away of a body. It's the causes the Buddha is talking about. What causes these things to arise and what causes them to pass away? Yes, Eddie? Yeah. Necessity, if it was a necessity, I'd be dead now. This is my 40th year as a monk. I haven't had sex for over 40 years. I'd be dead. I'm a human being too. It's not one of the nutriments. You mean I'm not normal? Aww. I always thought there was something a bit wrong with me. Yes, sensory contact is not just that. There's many other sensory contacts. It would be interesting if a person went into deep meditation for a long period of time, hardly any sensory contact. Could they pass away? Could their body just vanish? Interesting. Anyway, yeah, go on. Yeah, but there is one difference, and this is what happened to one guy who did that here. You're warm, you're not cold. Hopefully the doctors pick that up. So one difference between being a dead person and being someone in the deep jhanas. Your body is still warm. Yes? Well, apparently you can do more than that. Yeah, but the Buddha said 7 days. But other people can do more. Anyway, what are you going to say, doctor? No heartbeats. No heartbeats. No brain activity. Flat lines all along. So if you ever, Mukti, you're sort of, you know, sometimes working in emergency room. If you ever see someone like that from our Buddhist society, you know, give them another chance. Put them sort of in another room for a while and just see if they come out. Nah, don't give the shot. They don't. That doesn't do anything. They don't even feel it. So put them in a room, wait for them to come out, see if they're warm or not. Yeah. It is, yes. They can let go. You know, one of the problems with that is that people don't allow you to give up the will. They look at you and say, somebody told me this, they do it in the military or something. Stay with me. Keep looking, don't go. And so they stop you giving up the will to live. Or they run, don't go now, I will miss you. And so look, I'm dying, leave me alone. No, you can't. And so it's other people actually just, you know, stop you letting go.
they stop you giving up the will to live. A lot of times, people are very sick and old. They live for others. They survive for others. Where really they should be letting go. That's why I keep telling when somebody close to you is dying, please give them permission to go. So they can give up the will to live. Otherwise, they will keep going on, struggling against ridiculous odds. That's what it means to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the trouble, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Which is really sad. A lot of pain, so please never do that. Anyway, that's the origination, what it says in Satipatthana, to contemplate the origination of the body and its passing away. It doesn't mean just seeing people die and see people being born. It's where they come from, how the body keeps going, and what are the causes for it to disappear. The same is the origination of feelings. With the origination of contact, this is sensory contact. Basically, you have a sense based like the eye and you have something to see, and the two come together. That's the origin, it's the cause of sensory experience. What is it? And when, so maybe you shut your eye, you know, you, maybe things to see, but you can't see it, the contact is stopped, therefore it vanishes. And with that, you always get feelings, pleasant and unpleasant. So the cause of unpleasant feelings is just having senses. It's not your wife's fault, Ainsley. It's just being able to hear her. it's not the body's fault, it's just having a body. You're going to have happiness, a lot of pleasure, and a lot of frustration and pain as well. So with the arising of sensory contact, you're going to have both pleasant and unpleasant feelings. That's its cause. So you don't just see, oh, happiness comes, and now it's sad, now it's happy. Why? Because you have senses. And, now this is my favorite one, mind, citta is here. The arising of the citta and the passing away of the citta. They say here, origin of name and form, nama rupa. That is objects of the mind. Basically, form is things, stuff. And the other one, the what they call name, is now perception, will, sort of feelings, that's contact, that's all in this other stuff. When you have consciousness, you have to have something to be conscious of. Just like, you know, the simile I give, consciousness is like the TV set. And the name and form is what you see on a TV set. So, you know, to have a program, you know, you see you have to have the TV set. You know, the screen, if you like. Consciousness is like the screen, and what plays out on the screen of your six consciousnesses is like name and form. Sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, things which you know, that's all the programs on your six TV sets. What? Ah, now this is where that particular dependent origination, it says that name and form, this basically the stuff which you can see, that supports the mind. The mind supports that. That is just where that whole process of cause and effects turns around. One supports the other. One causes the other. Doesn't go beyond that, no. Because you don't find an original cause, like people always try to do. Okay, you know, why? You know, why is there consciousness? Because there's objects of consciousness. But why is there objects of consciousness? Because there's consciousness. That's where it turns around. So the Buddha actually gave another simile, which I often quote, the simile of the sheaves of reeds. Farming simile, you know, after you've done the harvest, you cut the straw and bale it up. You've got two big bales of straw leaning against each other. And if one is taken away, the other one falls. He said, this is the consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, mind. You have to have objects for those things to exist. The objects disappear, the consciousness disappears. So it says the arising, the cause of mind, is having something to be aware of. When there's nothing to be aware of, the mind, consciousness, ceases. And with it, you cease. Of course not. Because you need a mind and mind stuff to actually keep it going. There's a bit of momentum, the karma of being alive. But if at the end of your life there's nothing to be aware of, then your mind stops. And that's it, baby. You're done. You're out of here. It's okay. Over here, yeah, first. Have another life, because you still got the momentum keep going on. It doesn't really stop. Your last experience creates the next one. You can't let it go. Have you ever noticed you have trains of thought, series of experiences, one causes the next one, causes the next one, causes the next one. String of pearls, mostly jhana, your will keeps the process going. You get reborn because you want to. Yes. Oh, you can have stillness. Even as this is how the arupa states work. You know, you can have the awareness, the consciousness of nothing. Absolutely nothing. But then that's the third arupa state. And then that disappears. And with the sort of nothingness disappearing, the consciousness vanishes as well. You need both of them. It's like the sheaves of reeds falling apart. And then you have neither perception nor non-perception. So if it's the object is something, but there's nothing watching the object. And basically, and then that just jitta stops. Yeah. No, then you're in Nirodha Samapatti. That's just the deep states of incredible nothingness through meditation. But here, one of the reasons why I love this statement here is when people start talking about the original citta, original mind. You cannot have an original mind without it being aware of something. What is the nama rupa, the object, on this so-called original mind? Because without an object, without a nama rupa, there can't be a mind left. So all those original minders, that's where they get confused. No. The one which is letting go of everything has to vanish. Who's letting go of things? Yes. And then everything is let go of. Remember I gave a simile of the hand years and years ago. My hand, I'm always doing this, I'm always picking something up. You know what it's like, you know, you're picking something up. No, I picked it up, put it down again. And then you pick something else up, put it down. You know, my hand's always picking things up. So how can I stop picking things up? Cut off your hand. That's the only way I will ever stop picking things up. Because that's what my hand does. The sense of self that always grasps and attaches to stuff. That's just what it does. The only way to let go. Cut off Jacob Medin. When Jacob Medin doesn't exist anymore, only then will you stop grasping. That's what I say. Imagine you're an arahant. Imagine you're not there. So easy to let go then. Meditation is really easy then. As long as you can maintain the imagination long enough. Yeah, you have to let go of the one who's trying to do the letting go. The hand. Yeah. God. Bye-bye. Yeah. Anyway, where are we going? But that's the gist. And lastly, with the origination of attention is the origination of these dhammas, with the cessation of attention, the passing away of these dhammas, whatever it is. It just needs the attention there, which is obvious. But what a reason I say this particular sutta, because it's something which took me a long time to find, because I was always interested in the Satipatthana, where it says, if you read the whole Satipatthana Sutra, you see with each of these body, feelings, mind, and mind objects or dhammas, here said phenomena, you observe the arising, the passing away, both the arising and passing away in oneself, in others, in both. That's what that means. It doesn't mean you watch like waves going up and waves going down on a lake. You watch where those waves come from and how they cease without remainder. That is what the rise and fall means in the Satipatthana. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. It covers everything. Oh yeah, it's only that the shortened type is where they just go back to Vijnana and Namarupa. Or Chittavanamarupa, if you like. So in the beginning of this life, you know, where did your consciousness come from? What keeps it going? It needs something to feed it, to keep your consciousness going, and that is something to be aware of. When there's nothing to be aware of, your consciousness vanishes. This is not another way, but they intermesh. Shall we do the last sutta, number? Okay, you're gluttons for punishment. Okay, ill. This is the last book of the last of the four suttas I picked up here from the Satipatthana Samyutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali in Belawagamaka. Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus, "Come, monks, enter upon the rains wherever you have friends, acquaintances, and intimates in the vicinity of Vaisali. I myself will enter upon the rains right here in Belawagamaka." See, in a couple of weeks' time, the monks and the nuns are entering on the rains. So this is our old tradition from the earliest time. You get to the rains retreat, no more travelling, stay in one place. "Yes, venerable sir," those monks replied, "and they entered upon the rains wherever they had friends, acquaintances, and intimates in the vicinity of Vaisali, while the Blessed One entered upon the rains right there in Belawagamaka. Then when the Blessed One had entered upon the rains, a severe illness arose in him, and terrible pains bordering on death assailed him." That's his standard when you get sick. "But the Blessed One endured them, mindful and clearly comprehending without becoming distressed. Then the thought occurred to the Blessed One, 'It is not proper of me to attain final nirvana and just disappear without having addressed my attendants and taken leave of the Bhikkhu Sangha. Let me then suppress this illness by means of energy and live on, having resolved upon the life formation.' Then the Blessed One suppressed their illness by means of energy and lived on, having resolved upon the life formation," basically using the will to live to keep himself going. "The Blessed One then recovered from that illness, and soon after he had recovered, he came out from his dwelling and sat down in the seat that had been prepared in the shade behind the dwelling. Venerable Nanda then approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said to him, 'It's splendid, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One is bearing up. Splendid that he has recovered.'" Because Ananda loved the body. He's a very cute and sweet little character. You know, it's just sometimes you can imagine him just loved it, the little Buddha, so much that, you know, now he says, "But Venerable Sir, when the Blessed One was ill, my body seemed as if it were drugged. I'd become disorientated. The teachings were not clear to me. Nevertheless, I had this much consolation. Surely the Blessed One would not attain final nirvana without having made some pronouncement concerning the Bhikkhu Sangha." "What does the Bhikkhu Sangha now expect from me, Ananda? I have taught the Dhamma, Ananda, without making a distinction between inside and outside. The Tathagata has no closed fist of a teacher in regard to the teachings." This is one of the great sayings. So
No inside, no inner circle and outer circle. Now, there's some teachings I only teach to my monks, and only some of my monks, and I don't share it with you. That's, you know, sometimes you have that in some sort of traditions, but the Buddha said, no, there's no inside and outside. He doesn't teach with a closed fist, keeping some secrets away from people. It was totally open. What he knew, he just declared. No secret teachings. You know, a lot of people will actually mention this. You know, when people say, well, what about all of those teachings which were supposed to have been so profound that no one in the time of the Buddha could have understood them. So he gave them to the Naga realm. And they were only discovered 1,000 years later, you know, 500 years later by the Mahayana. These were secret teachings of the Buddha which only revealed when people were wise enough to understand them. We quote this, look, the Buddha never kept a closed fist. He never kept secret teachings. Everything was revealed. And the same with the Abhidhamma. It's not mentioned in the sutras. It's only supposed, I was talking to Arana Vihari and he said, well, the Buddha taught this to the devas, never taught it to the monks. That's a bit sort of against what we say here. The, you know, there's no inner and outer. So, it couldn't have been taught at all by the Buddha. So, that's the first saying in the sutta. Very powerful. He never kept a closed fist. The teachings were open, never hid anything. No secret teachings, no special teachings only for some and not for others. And the next thing is even more powerful. If Ananda, anyone thinks, I will take charge of the Bhikkhu Sangha, or the Bhikkhu Sangha is under my direction, it is he who should make some pronouncement concerning the Bhikkhu Sangha. But Ananda, it does not occur to the Tathagata, I will take charge of the Bhikkhu Sangha, or the Bhikkhu Sangha is under my direction. So why should the Tathagata make some pronouncement concerning the Bhikkhu Sangha? Now I am old, Ananda, age burdened with years, advancing might come to the last stage. My age is now turning 80, just as an old cart keeps going by a combination of straps. So it seems this body of the Tathagata keeps going by a combination of straps. So this was one of the first time when the Buddha was asked, who's going to lead the Bhikkhu Sangha? He said, no, one is going to lead the Bhikkhu Sangha. And later on he made it even more clear. He said, after I am gone, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that will lead the Sangha once I'm gone. No popes, no Mahanayakas, no Sangharajas. You know who... We had a nice monk do some research. You know where Mahanayakas came from? They were invented by the British Raj. That was the way they controlled the Sangha in Sri Lanka. Typical British Raj stuff. They were really good at this. You know, you find that this whole Sangha, which everyone worshipped in Sri Lanka, appointing a few of them to be leaders. And the British Raj, they were the appointers. So if you didn't do the right job, we wouldn't appoint you as a Mahanayaka. And that's the way they got control over the Sangha. And now we have all these Mahanayakas in Sri Lanka. Nothing to do with Buddhism. Everything to do with the shenanigans of my ancestors. That's where it came from. Yeah. Sorry? That's a really, really interesting point. Now that's a really interesting point. The Arahats take the leadership role. That is one of the reasons why good monks will never say. So you don't know who the Arahats are. They think they know. But this is one of the problems. And unfortunately there are some monks who, actually they don't say they're Arahats. What they do is they say to their friend, the monks, and their monks tell everybody else. So it's just, you know, the same thing really. And the reason they do that is to get power in the Sangha. There's a leader here, but they have not got any authority. No legal authority. They may have, basically leaders out front, but when it comes around to the real decisions, I really enforce this in Bodhinyana. I know in some other monasteries it's not enforced, but the decisions are Sangha.
All the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery, they all have a vote. Do I get outvoted sometimes?
You do.
You do? Rarely. Rarely, but I do get. Sorry? Yeah, it has to, it's only just beginning to grow, but it has to come back to the Vinaya, which is everyone has a vote. Every vote is equal. Yeah, we're getting there anyway. But, you know, the whole idea of Mahanayakas and Sangharajas, popes in Buddhism, that's, you can't establish that. There's no basis for it. Sometimes it happens. There are Mahanayakas. There are Sangharajas. There are abbots. But there's no basis for it. Are preeminent, yeah, but they didn't have any more votes in meetings than others. And they looked at them, yeah, they'll always do that. But at least, you know, you can't have a pope. You can't have this person whose decision, even when it's crazy, has to be followed. Yeah. Oh yeah, you get more respect and that gives you, you know, more power, more of a leadership role. But it means that, you know, I haven't got that much power. If I'm doing something really stupid, you know, the monks can overrule me very easily. Each monastery is different. So the whole idea, say in Thailand, of that hierarchy, people actually know that now. It has no basis. So they, I remember in the troubles, political troubles over there, they want to even reform the Sangha in Thailand and get rid of all these hierarchies in the Sangha in Thailand. Yeah. What's the other extreme of too much democracy? No. A dysfunctional democracy. Yeah, too many. That's called Australian House of the Parliament. I don't know. Anyway, I'll get into politics, and I'm going to be in big trouble whenever I start this. So here we go. Okay. So then, now the Buddha carries on. It's the bottom of page 4. Whenever Ananda, by non-attention to all signs and cessation of certain feelings, the Tathagata enters upon and dwells in the signless stillness of mind. On that occasion, Ananda, the body of the Tathagata is more comfortable. Therefore, Ananda, dwell with yourself. Oh, I should mention what this actually is. Non-attention to all signs. And sometimes that always like to, I've already, well, not really slagged the Mahayana, but sort of said these old sutras in the, which people said were stored in the Naga realm, doesn't really make any sense. But there's always now and again they say some really good things. And one of the great teachings in Mahayana is the sixth Zen patriarch's little teachings, his poem. The path is easy when you have no preferences. We have no choice, no judging. And that's like animitta. You need a sign, you need some characteristic to judge a person. Layman, sangha, girl, boy, good, bad. When you take away all those signs, you cannot judge. When you cannot judge, you cannot do anything. When you cannot do anything, you get still very quickly. So the animitta, based on non-judging, not having any signs on which you can compare, you still get very still. This is what the Buddha was saying. That his body becomes really comfortable. Therefore, Nanda, dwell with yourself as your own island, with yourself as your own refuge, with no other refuge. Well, he's saying that the Buddha is dying. Dwell with the Dharma as your island, with the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. And how, Ananda, does the bhikkhu dwell with himself as his own island, with himself as his own refuge, with no other refuge? With the Dhamma as the island, the Dhamma as the refuge, with no other refuge. Here, Ananda, a monk dwells, nun, layman, laywoman, dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehended, mindful, having removed the first two hindrances, dwells contemplating feelings, mind, phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed the two hindrances. That is how you dwell with the Dharma as a refuge, not with a person as a refuge. Now this is brilliant. So you're not worshipping a guru. You're not sort of taking the Buddha, especially when the Buddha is passing away, not to sort of relying on that. Relying on the Dhamma, the training. Doing some Satipatthana. Those monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, Ananda, either now or after I am gone, who dwell with themselves as their own island, with themselves as their own refuge, with no other refuge, with the Dhamma as their island, with the Dhamma as their refuge, with no other refuge. It is those monks, nuns, and laymen, laywomen, Ananda, who will be for me, topmost of those keen on the training. So just praise it that these will be the best, the creme de la creme. Yeah? Yeah, it was. No, the story behind that was purely fortuitous. It was just because I met two other monks in Bangkok and they said, come and have a look. And I went to have a look. My first impression was he was a crazy monk. No, really, you know, he was just praising me for something I was doing and I was not doing it well. He wasn't being honest, he was just almost trying to suck up to me. But then the turning point came as sometimes it does, something happens. I think I told many of you that story that I was doing some work and there was another monk who wanted to ask questions of Ajahn Chah. So he got the translator, he asked his questions, translated into Thai, Ajahn Chah answered and got the translation back. And I noticed the answer Ajahn Chah gave had nothing to do with the question this monk asked. It was a really strange answer, but I noticed he was answering a question I was thinking about. And then this monk asked another question. Translated into Thai, Ajahn Chah gave a response, translated back into English. And again, it had no bearing on the second question the monk asked, but was the question I was thinking about. And I kept on thinking these questions. You know, I'm not saying anything to anybody. And Ajahn Chah kept answering my questions. And afterwards I asked this he was actually a novice, Gary his name, was the same guy, you know, who was told about get the bottle of shit from your girlfriend. Same one. And I asked him afterwards, said, what do you think of Ajahn Chah's answer? He said, it's absolutely crazy. They didn't ask him. I didn't understand any one of them. And he said, it's because he wasn't answering your questions, he was answering mine. I was thinking them and he was answering them. And you know, that was really sort of spooky. But you know, I thought, well, this guy's got some power, so I better stick around this guy. And that was one of the reasons why. It's always constantly impressing me with things like that. That's why I stay with him, because not that he was a leader, because he obviously had something to teach. Yeah. Oh yeah, I did stay with him. Yeah. And again, that, in a sense, I see what you mean, that was a leadership. A sense of faith, yeah, and a leadership of somebody who has the authority because they know something much more than you. And you want to stay with them to try and pick up as much as you can. Okay, so that's some suttas from the Satipatthana Sanghita. Because all the time, sometimes, you know, I'm concerned about people being taught properly, and all the time you get the Satipatthana Sutta, you just get the usual Satipatthana Sutra, and you don't get any more to it. These Satipatthana Sanghita, it just opens up that teaching to give a much, much deeper and fuller appreciation of the Buddha's teachings on the four foundations of mindfulness. And when it includes the Samatha, the Jhanas, and includes all sorts of other interesting stuff. So that's why I'm pointing your attention if you want to study Satipatthana some more. Also go in this book as well, the Sanghita Nikaya, and there you see more, which fleshes out just one or two sutras which are interesting, but this gives it more breadth and answers many questions. Okay. Very. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Unfortunately, that's the last of the sutta classes after the rains. But they're all online, and you can go and sort of get a few of them afterwards. Quick, yeah. All of the Buddha's teachings were spoken, nothing was written down. And he did not keep any secrets. So even the most deep teachings he would teach to people, some would understand, some wouldn't, but he would not stop teaching those. So he didn't keep anything secret. He didn't just have a few monks he said one thing to and didn't say to others. Everything was open. No secret hidden teachings. Yeah.
Okay, but even you talk the same subject, even in the room, some people might understand, some people might not. I talk about whole group of people, you know, like the same Dharma teaching, but understand everything to understand the different.
Yeah, that's it.
Yes.
People would have the listeners would have closed minds or open minds, but the Buddha would always teach everything. So at least it was open for people to understand. They would not understand because the Buddha never taught it. There was no sort of secret teachings, you know, only for a few. Everything was open. Okay, so let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha now.